All right, so it is now April 15th, tax day, although tax day has been postponed. This is Wednesday, and we have our lecture today, which is going to be on Hammond postulate, and then we'll look at a bunch of different reaction mechanisms and start to look at some mechanism components. And I was going to go over just a short review of where we left off on Monday and ask if there was any questions before I get going and kind of address any questions first and then sort of jump into lecture. I'm a little shell-shocked from this morning. This morning's lab did not go exactly the way that I had planned it to, although that happens sometimes even when you're in person in the classroom. So I'm going to redouble my efforts for this afternoon. And those people from the morning lab, hopefully if I can get this right in the afternoon lab, you may want to go back and take a look at the afternoon lab recording once I get it up, because maybe I'll have things in better order and you can watch it a second time. Although I think I got the content out this morning that I wanted to. It just didn't go as smoothly as I wanted. And that's the way it rolls sometimes. Okay. Any questions this morning in terms of how you guys are doing? I saw people were handing in the quiz. I see quizzes coming in by email, which is great. That's what I'm looking for. So those quizzes are due at some point today. That would be great if you can get those quizzes in there. If you can get them into me in PDF format, that would be even easier for me to deal with. And I think I discussed with my Chem 3L class yesterday, depending upon the platform that you're on and what type of cell phone you have, if you have an iPhone, one of my favorite applications is this guy here. This guy is, let's see where I've got the name of it actually. It's TurboScan. And TurboScan is a fantastic app. It allows you to be able to just take a picture with your cell phone that converts it into a PDF automatically. And then from within TurboScan, you can email that PDF out to whatever email address you want. And the nice thing about it is let's say that you have a 5-page document or a 7-page document. You can take a picture, click an add button, take another picture, click the add button. And each time you take a picture, it takes and adds to the ongoing file all of the pages. So it puts all the pages in one PDF in one file, and then you can email out that one file. So it's a very convenient way of converting files into PDFs. TurboScan is the name of that application. It's a Mac application for iPads and for cell phones, for iPhones. There may be an analog to that on Android or on other types of phones. Any sort of scanning app that can convert into a PDF so that you can work on paper, take a picture of it, convert it to a PDF, just makes it a little bit easier for me. I'll still take the photos. If that's all you've got and that's what's working for you, then by all means, I'll still take photos. But if you can get them all into a single PDF, particularly when they're multiple pages, that would really streamline my job and make it a lot easier on me in terms of grading these things. So that's a little bit about that. And yesterday when we were talking about that with some of the students in Chem 3, there was a number of different applications that some of the students had known about already that other instructors they're working with. All instructors are trying to get things in PDF because it's a lot easier for us to mark that up and to send it back and to have it all in one contiguous file. So anything that you can do to try to amalgamate it into a PDF would be helpful. Let's see, what else do we need to do? I don't know. We can go back and sort of review where we left off on Monday. And if there aren't any other further questions, Finley has assumed his position. Finley is hanging out with me here. And so I want to say hi, Finn, real quick. He's like, no, I'm sleeping and this is lecture time and I'm supposed to take a nap. So he's sacked out and we're ready to go for lecture. Cam scanner. Okay, Katrina, great. That's another good one. Cam scanner is also very good. Yeah, there's some good ones out there. So assistant, okay, great. Everybody, if you have good applications and you just want to throw out some of those names into the chat, other people can get a hold of those and see those. That's a good thing to share so that we all have shared resources. Okay, so we left off on Monday and we were looking at energy diagrams. And we were looking at both the kinetics, which is related to the activation energy, and the thermodynamics, which is related to the delta G, which is the difference in energy between the reactants and products. And we looked at how the activation energy and the delta G are related to product distributions, where we talked about this idea of kinetic versus thermodynamics. So kinetics being speed, being fast to form, thermodynamics being stability, being the most stable product. And that we found that there were two different types of graphs that we can have. We can have ones where a product, say C that is here, can have both the lowest activation energy and the lowest energy in terms of the product. And therefore it is both fast to form and it is also the most stable product, and therefore it is the favored product under all different conditions. So that was one concept. The other concept that we discussed was that we can have one thing have the low activation energy, but the other have the low delta G. And so one product is fast to form, and the other product is most stable. In this case, we have two different products, and the two different products can be formed by two different conditions. One condition, called the kinetic condition, is favored by low temperature and short reaction times. And that would make C the favored product when reacting under low temperature and short reaction times. The other concept was that we could have thermodynamic that is favored by high heat and long reaction times. And that would make D major under those types of conditions. Those are conditions that favor the formation of the most stable product. So we can have kinetic control and thermodynamic control, and we can have situations where a product is both the kinetic and the thermodynamic product. And those concepts are what we hit on Monday. So let's pick up from there. Let's start a new, that's not what I want to do. Let's start a new note. And this one is going to be for today. This is Wednesday. April 15th. And we're going to start off by looking at transition states a little bit. So transition states The transition state, when we look at an energy diagram, is the point at the top of the energy diagram up here. And we use the symbol that is meant to resemble what's called a double dagger. I think that traditionally when you draw that symbol, that that symbol has a slightly longer upper than lower. That's called the double dagger. And the double dagger is the symbol that we use for transition states. Transition states are not observable or isolatable. But they are critically important to understanding chemical reactions and understanding where the transition state is, what the transition state looks like. Is fundamentally important to understanding many of the chemical reactions, because the transition state tells us about how to influence the chemical reaction. So if we want to speed the reaction up, or if we want to slow it down, or if we want to increase the yield of a particular product, then we need to understand what is occurring within the transition state in order to have control over the chemical reaction. So knowing what the transition state looks like is immensely powerful. And yet transition states are not observable or isolatable because they happen on the time scale of a bond vibration. Basically what's happening there is bond making and bond breaking are occurring at the same time. So when these are occurring at the same time, they are essentially occurring on the order of a bond vibration. And what we mean by that is on a time scale of a bond vibration, which is in the picoseconds. It is incredibly small time scale from the point that we go from one side of the transition state to the other side of the transition state, that is picoseconds, if not femtoseconds. And it's an incredibly fast time scale in the transition from one side to the other side. And the transition state is the moment right smack in the center between bond breaking and bond making. And yet the transition state can look like a lot of different things. The transition state can be an early transition state or a late transition state. And getting your head around, wrapping your head around what a transition state actually looks like is not an easy concept. So for instance, we have a chemical reaction. Let's take a chemical reaction that is, this is an SN2 reaction. So what I have is a chloride ion and it's reacting with methyl bromide. And in this SN2 reaction, the chloride ion is going to hit the backside of this carbon and knock out the bromide. And in so doing, I'm going to move all this over just a little bit. In so doing, what we create is the chloride now connected to the carbon. And the hydrogens are flipped to the other side of the molecule. And the bromide is kicked out. So what is happening in between? What does the transition state look like? And the transition state for this reaction looks sort of like this. We have the chloride. It has a partial minus charge on it. It is partially bound to the carbon that is in a trigonal planar orientation, which is partially bound to the bromide, which has a partial minus on it. And all of this is what we call the transition state. And bond making and bond breaking are happening at the same time. So we have the bond that is being made. So this is the new bond. And the bond which is breaking. As those two are occurring at the same time, you might think, well, then the transition state is just a blending of the two. But it's not really. The transition state can be an early transition state or a late transition state. So by early, we mean that bond making is happening or occurring before bond breaking, or it can be a late transition state where the bond breaking is occurring before the bond making. And what the transition state looks like really depends upon the energy of the chemical reaction and looking at an energy diagram. So the energy diagram for this reaction, if we were to look at it, we would have to take the chloride ion and the CH3Br and the H3C, now with the chloride on it, I put that in the wrong direction, let's do it this way. Chloride to CH3, and then the Br minus. So these are the reactants and the products as they have been formed. And the energy of the chemical reaction would go through an activation energy barrier and come down. The transition state would be sitting here. So this image of this transition state gets dragged down. Make room for it so it's there. So our transition state goes at the top of that. And this is our activation energy. And there's a postulate called Hammond postulate that tells us what the transition state looks like. So the Hammond postulate was stated by George Hammond. And this is one of my favorite parts of organic chemistry. Because I go back and I use it so much. If two states are similar in energy, then they are similar in structure. So, and this is stated, this is the Hammond postulate. The Hammond postulate, I never really understood until I needed to teach. And when I needed to teach organic chemistry and trying to understand what the transition state looks like, a light bulb just sort of went off on how important the Hammond postulate really is. And I think it's how it's taught and how it's applied that really makes its value known. And so if we take a look at the Hammond postulate, what we're saying is that if we have a chemical reaction that is an exothermic chemical reaction, that what the Hammond postulate says is that if the transition state is close in energy to the reactants, it will be structurally similar to the reactants. And if the transition state is structurally similar to the product, then it will look like the product. That's what Hammond postulate says. So here the transition state is reactant-like. And here the transition state is product-like. We just look to see which side it resembles by which side it's closest in energy to. So another way of rephrasing this is the transition state will look like the side it is closest in energy to. That's what the Hammond postulate says. So if we take this energy diagram and we think about what this means for this energy diagram, this means that the transition state that we were viewing moments ago that looked like it was an equal transition state really wasn't. It was a transition state that, because of the exothermic nature of this chemical reaction, the transition state should be reactant-like. What does it mean to be reactant-like? Well, what that means is that the chloride is going to be farther away from this carbon. The carbon is going to be a little bit more tetrahedral in nature, not entirely tetrahedral, but close to tetrahedral. And the bromide will not be as far away from the carbon in the actual transition state. The transition state is going to look like the reactants, which means that I'm going to have a large partial minus on the chloride and a small partial minus on the bromide, and that it will not be that the carbon is entirely trigonal planar, but that the carbon is more sp3 than it is trigonal planar in the transition state, in the bond making and bond breaking process. So that this transition state is what we call an early transition state. And you say, well, okay, well, where does that get me? Now I can tell whether the transition state is reactant-like or product-like, and that gets you a long way, because this starts to tell you what different types of things are going to affect your transition state. They tell what solvent is going to do your transition state, what temperature is going to do, what sterics are going to do. All of these different factors then can be related into the transition state to understand their effect on the transition state, because now we know the structure of it. That's what the Hammond postulate does. And we will use this every time we introduce a new chemical reaction. We will look at the transition state, we will use Hammond postulate, and we will make arguments about how this molecule is affected by the transition state. For instance, just in this molecule alone, if we were to look at this, this is an early type transition state, and that this transition state is governed by the chloride attacking the backside of the carbon. And these hydrogens, because they are sort of tetrahedral in their orientation around the carbon, what that means is that if I replace those hydrogens with carbons and I increase the sterics around this, the more sterics there are around this, the harder it is for the chloride to be able to get in there, and the higher the activation of the chemical reaction is going to be. So this reaction is going to be sterics governed, and then I can predict which reactions are going to go faster and which reactions are going to go slower by the sterics that are around the carbon in this chemical reaction. So if I change to a different substrate, what Hammond postulate can tell me is that if I look at this reaction, chloride attacking the carbon with the hydrogens attached to it and the bromide leaving, versus a chloride which is attacking a carbon which has CH3 groups here. And we'll just put a couple of CH3 groups on here. And then we'll put one hydrogen in the back and a bromide leaving. There's much more sterics in the right-hand one than there are in the left-hand one. And so what happens in the chemical reaction is that in the right-hand reaction, I have a low activation energy. In the right-hand reaction, if I keep everything sort of aligned in the same sort of way, my sterics are much higher and my reaction much slower due to sterics. So I have a higher activation energy and slower rate of reaction. And
hey, Jason?
Yeah, go for it.
Quick question. When you say early transition state, does that mean that bonds are forming before they're breaking?
When I say early transition state, yes, in some regards, we're saying that I think that what we tend to say is that it is more reactant-like, and that the bond that is forming is forming ahead of bond breaking. That the bond breaking is happening a little bit later after the transition state,
okay,
whereas the bond making is happening a little bit early. So while we say that bond making and bond breaking are simultaneous, they're not simultaneous unless you happen to have a chemical reaction. Unless your chemical reaction looks like this, let's see, where do I want to go? Unless we have reactants and products that are at about the same amount of energy, then there is no difference in the transition state. The transition state is a perfectly even transition state that looks both like the reactants and like the products, and it is smack dab in the middle. And bond breaking and bond making are occurring simultaneously. But we generally don't have chemical reactions that look like that. Generally, our chemical reactions are asymmetric, and they're either endothermic or exothermic. And that means the transition state has a different shape to it, that it can be more early or more late.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. All right, so this is just sort of one example of Hammond postulate, and we will come back over and over again to Hammond postulate. Let me choose, we've looked at the chloride one. Let me give you one more example of another type of reaction. But Finley, you gotta like lay down, buddy, and not stand on my arm. You can stand on the chair. All right, let's look at a chemical reaction now that is, we looked at an exothermic reaction. Let's look at an endothermic reaction. In this reaction, what we have is a tertiary carbon. This is tertiary butyl bromide. And the chemical reaction that is occurring is the loss of the bromide going to a carbocation, and the bromide anion. So this is a decomposition type of reaction. And in this reaction, what is occurring is we're going from a low energy state where we have the tertiary butyl bromide, and we're going to a high energy state where I have the carbocation and the bromide ion, and the transition state appears up here. The transition state is closest in energy to the reactant side. Ah, keep saying that wrong. I just, for some reason, I got to slow down my brain and just, so closest in energy to the product side. And so what the transition state is going to look like here is that our transition state is going to be mostly trigonal planar. Let's do it trigonal planar so that we can see it. Finn, you're going to have to jump down because you're wanting to. He like, when he gets tired and he doesn't want me to lecture anymore, he tends to just sort of lean over and put his head on the iPad. So here's my developing partial positive and the bromide, which is leaving and gets the developing minus charge in it. And that is sort of the geometry of the transition state. In this case, bond breaking is very developed and the carbon has a large partial positive in it. So we have a large partial positive on carbon. And the bromine is mostly dissociated. So this type of chemical reaction allows us to look at it and to think about the transition state and what is going to be affecting this type of transition state. In this case, because the carbocation here is trigonal planar, sterics are not a problem. There's no sterics. So this type of chemical reaction is not governed by sterics. This type of chemical reaction is governed by the stability of the forming carbocation. And anything that stabilizes the carbocation is going to bring down the activation energy. Anything that increases the energy of the carbocation is going to raise the energy. So we're allowed then to be able to figure out what is going to affect the activation energy. So anything that stabilizes carbocations will bring the activation energy down. And anything that destabilizes carbocations will increase the activation energy. And so if we can understand the carbocation, then we can understand this type of chemical reaction. And that's what I mean by the power of looking at the transition state, that when we know what the transition state looks like, we can talk about the factors that affect the transition state, sterics, electronics, those types of factors, and then we can gain control over the chemical reactions. We can then start to design chemical reactions to make them do what we want them to do, rather than just observing them and say, what happens in this chemical reaction? We can actually take control over a chemical reaction, and we can design chemical reactions that will optimize product yields by changing some aspect of the chemical reaction, either changing temperature, changing solvent, changing the sterics around a molecule, changing the substrate itself, changing the nucleophile. All of these different factors will give us control over the chemical reaction, and all of that happens through Hammond postulate. So really, controlling organic chemistry is about understanding transition states, and that comes from understanding Hammond postulate, which is why Hammond postulate is just the absolute bomb, because it allows you to be able to understand chemical reactions in a way that you couldn't if you didn't know what the transition state looks like. And because we can't observe transition states, because there's no ability to be able to view a transition state directly, because they are theoretical and can only be calculated using computational chemistry, we need things like the Hammond postulate in order to be able to estimate what the transition state actually looks like. Okay, so I've been ignoring the chat, and I apologize. Let's see, Finn asks, does the atomic scale apply to this reaction as well, because chlorine is more electronegative? The atomic scale, all of these are occurring at the atomic scale, and the question, chlorine is more electronegative than bromine, but it's not necessarily the reaction being governed by electronegativity in these cases. They're being governed in a different format by concentration, and also by a decrease in sterics. That is, the chloride comes in as the nucleophile, bromide is displaced, bromide was a larger, we have a decrease in back strain. Those are things that we'll have to talk about. So it's not just pure electronegativity, that's to Finn. Francisco, and are the products are lower in energy? I'm not exactly sure where that question was in regard to. Francisco, do you want to chime in? And
yeah, that was farther up with the, yeah, right there.
Okay.
Down to the chlorine and bromine, those two energy diagrams next to each other?
Yes. But in terms of the two energy diagrams, I see. I think that what I meant to do is that still, let me erase partially rather than whole. I meant to kind of have these two be at the same level so that our products are about the same amount of energy and our reactants are about the same amount of energy, but it's the transition state energy that is really different.
Okay, makes sense.
Okay, cool. And Finn, you have then bromide. I'm not sure what that means, but I may have misspoken. And so maybe you were correcting me in what I was speaking. That's cool too. And Roxana, how do catalysts play a role in this? And that is an excellent question. The catalyst, what a catalyst does is it changes the path of a given reaction. So if we imagine that we have a reaction, non-specific reaction, that is a, and I'm just gonna make a really big sort of swoopy activation energy here, and that this is my transition state of the uncatalyzed. Then what happens with a catalyst is the catalyst literally changes the reaction mechanism by going through a series of steps and intermediates that change the activation energy overall while taking me to the same place. And so now I have a series of transition states, all with their individual activation energies, and whichever one of these activation energies is the tallest would be the rate determining step. So this might be the rate determining step because it has the largest activation energy. Still, that activation energy is lower than the original activation energy would have been, which means that the chemical reaction is sped up by a catalyst by going through an alternative pathway. and a very different sort of transition states, and maybe even intermediates in the chemical reaction. So catalysts completely change the reaction mechanism while not changing the reactants or products. And the catalysts don't show up in the reactants or products, so the catalysts are oftentimes just recycled. And hopefully catalytic, meaning that they can do this in a cycle, that whatever catalyst you're using is not stoichiometric, but repeats over and over again. So it changes the pathway, is the answer to that one. That's how catalysts play a role in this. And by Hammond postulate says the same sort of thing, that if we want to understand the catalyzed chemical reaction, the original transition state would have been, in this case, reactant-like for the uncatalyzed. But the catalyzed reaction for the rate-determining step, if I look at the transition state there, that transition state is going to be based on this energy and this energy, and the transition state for the catalyzed one is going to look like this intermediate. And that may be very different than what the original uncatalyzed chemical reaction looked like. So that's kind of how a catalyst can play a role. And we can still get the same sort of information using Hammond postulate about the uncatalyzed versus the catalyzed, and make decisions about how to affect the catalyzed reaction such that we can speed that up or lower that activation energy. The whole game that we're playing here is we're trying to figure out this, that when we have a transition state, if we know what the transition state looks like, and that this is our activation energy, anything that we can do that will make that activation, that will destabilize the transition state, will increase the activation energy. And slow the reaction down. Anything that we can do that will stabilize the transition state will lower the activation energy and speed the reaction up. And we can only make those decisions when we understand what the transition state looks like. And that's why Hammond postulate helps us out, is because Hammond postulate helps us to know what the transition state looks like so that we can approximate it, and then we can determine what factors will affect it. And then we can compare rates of chemical reactions and understand why one reaction might go faster than another. To that, it also helps us to understand why one reaction might go faster in one solvent than it might in another solvent, or how changing the temperature on a chemical reaction might affect things. All of these different factors that we'll look at all stem from Hammond postulate. Okay, so those are all great questions. Anything more? Because I'm going to transition out of Hammond postulate now. I'm going to transition into some different common mechanistic steps and some nomenclature. And Hammond postulate's not going to go away. It's going to keep coming back. But I think for now, I've hit it about as hard as I need to hit it in an introductory way. And we can't really address it more until we start looking at chemical reactions. And the step before we start looking at chemical reactions is about looking at some vocabulary, making sure that we understand and have a common vocabulary, and also looking at reaction mechanistic steps so that we have a language of mechanisms to use as we go forward to talk about different chemical reactions. So that's kind of where we're going. So let me pause for a second and see if there's anything else you guys want to ask about this Hammond postulate and this idea of being able to stabilize or destabilize transition states.
So can you explain to me how it stabilizes and destabilizes one more time? So like, it's stable if it speeds up, but it's not stable if it
It's not about speeding it up or slowing it down. Stabilizing versus destabilizing. What that, I mean, if I give you sort of an example, let's take the example that was the carbocation that I was forming. So if we take the chemical reaction where I have this bromide group leaving, and this is the first step in what's called an SN1 substitution nucleophilic first order. This is the first step in that type of chemical reaction. And what we get is the formation of a carbocation. The solvent that we use here is critically important to allowing this chemical reaction to occur, so that I'm going from a neutral molecule to a cation, an anion, to ions. We could just say ions. So if I think about the types of solvents that will support ions and the types of solvents that do not support ions, so we could say that we can have, hang on a second, I'll be right back. Sorry, Finley decided he was done with lecture and he wanted the heck out of this room. So rather than have him destroy my door, I had to give him the boot. Okay, so we were saying that solvents that support carbocations versus do not support carbocations. We could just say ions in general. And you guys know that different solvents support ions and don't. For instance, we know that ions dissolve readily in water. And what water has going for it is that this is a highly polar solvent. But water doesn't support most organic mechanisms, but we could think of other solvents that would support, that are similar to water. So things that are similar to water are methanol or ethanol or even acetic acid. That these are highly polar solvents and these things will stabilize ion formation. Solvents that are hydrocarbons, like pentane, cyclohexane, toluene, these types of solvents, these are nonpolar, and they destabilize ion formation. They do not support. Ion formation. So in a sense, when I look at this chemical reaction, and this chemical reaction was an endothermic type of reaction. So we have the ion formation and we have the starting material. And we have our energy diagram and our transition state. And I want to move all this down just a little bit to make room for it, that because the transition state is product-like, anything that supports the carbocation is going to decrease the activation energy and make the reaction run faster. So these are going to be polar solvents. And those polar solvents are going to make for a new activation energy, which is going to be a very small activation energy. But if I change the solvent and I make the solvent a nonpolar solvent, that's going to increase the activation energy and my chemical reaction, the rate will slow down because my activation energy will increase. And so understanding the transition state allows me to actually tailor the chemical reaction to make it run more efficiently or less efficiently by changing the solvent, just as one example. There are many other examples that we can show that would play into this that would either raise or lower that activation energy. Solvent is just one factor. Does that help, Finn?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, anybody else? All questions are good. All right. If there's no further questions on that, let's start with this next part, which we're going to start looking at the parts of chemical reactions. And in order to look at the parts of chemical reactions, we need some common language. Nucleophile and electrophile. These are terms that we use that describe the different components of a chemical reaction, and any reaction can be broken down into nucleophile and electrophile. So a nucleophile is an electron-rich species. It is looking for either a cation or a partial positive to react with. So in terms of things that look like nucleophiles, we can have oxygen anions or even just an oxygen with lone pairs, or it can even be a double bond that is electron rich. So the things that are electron rich here, we can point to, and we can say the negative charge, which is the extra pair of electrons. A pair of electrons can be nucleophilic, can attack a positive charge or a partial positive charge. And in regards to the double bond here, it is the pi bond and the electrons that are in the pi bond which form the nucleophile, that are the electrons that are of the double bond. Much like a lone pair, those electrons are accessible and can react with positive charges or partial positive charges. The electrophile, an electrophile is an electron deficient species. So this is an electron poor species. It's looking for a anion, a negative charge or a partial negative charge to react with. So things that are like this, protons, simplest thing, carbocations with positive charges, things with partial positive charges, the carbonyl due to its polarity, where the oxygen is partial minus and the carbon is partial positive, or even a bond that is a polar bond where there is a partial positive and partial minus. So the areas here, the cations, the partial positive charges, these are the electrophilic species, and they are looking for negative charges or partial negative charges to react with. So in regards to this, just in general chemical theory, what we're saying is that a nucleophile is something that when we look at its energy diagram that has electrons that are in it. This is the barycenter. There may be more bonds below and more bonds above. This is called the highest occupied molecular orbital. And in an electrophile, we have the same sort of scheme, but it's shifted off. And I need to shift it off just a little bit more. Let's get rid of this one. We'll move it down. This is the center for here. And the electrons that are in the occupied. And there may be more electrons on both sides of this. This orbital is called the lowest unoccupied molecular orbital. So these get abbreviated into the HOMO and the LUMO. And what happens is the electrons here are higher in energy than the LUMO and will transfer to the LUMO. So what we're seeing is that these are the electrons which are partial minus, and the electron hole essentially that is over here that is partial positive. And electrons always sort of flow to their lower energy state, which is why nucleophiles and electrophiles react with each other in the way that they do. It is the flow of electrons from a high energy state to a low energy state that that helps to make the chemical reaction go forward. And so we're looking at the presence of electrons versus the absence of electrons. And that's what our nucleophiles and electrophiles literally are. And every single chemical reaction with as much diversity and an infinite number of examples can be shown where we have partial negatives and partial positives and things going on. So we've just broken it down into the very tiniest little subset, 3 or 4 examples of each one of these. And we'll see as we go through the entire year that there will be many more. We'll just break down every single chemical reaction into nucleophiles and electrophiles in the way that we talk about the different reactants. So much like when you learned acid-base and you learned that there was acids and that there was bases and that that was governed by the way that they react and that we have different definitions. We have the Bronsted-Lowry acids and bases, and then we have Lewis acids and bases, and we keep expanding out that definition, and the Lewis acid bases encompasses Bronsted-Lowry as well, that nucleophile and electrophile are sort of over-guiding principles like that, that even take acid-base, and we can now convert acid-base into nucleophile and electrophile. It's just one more level of looking at how things react and classifying two reactants doing two particular types of jobs. And it's just that acid-base is too limiting within organic chemistry. And so we have these broader terms, nucleophile and electrophile, that we tend to use. Okay? And we'll keep highlighting them out as we go through and look at chemical reactions. Let's look at some common mechanistic steps, though, now. And within each one of these common mechanistic steps, we can also highlight out electrophiles and nucleophiles as we're doing it to get better examples. So this comes under arrow pushing, as well as naming some of these different steps. So one of the steps that we can do here is a step where we have a cation and something that has a negative charge on it. And the arrow pushing that we would use is a curved arrow. So we're always still trying to use curved arrows. Sometimes you'll see me use a nice curved arrow. Sometimes you'll see me do sort of a directional type of arrow. I generally meaning the same sort of thing in that the flow of electrons, that we're looking at where electrons are present to and where they're going to. So we're using this arrow to represent the flow of electrons. And then we can also show the outcome of that flow of electrons in that there is a new chemical bond that is made. And I guess we'll do our new bonds in red so that we can kind of see where things are going. And we have the new bond that is made there. This is an example of nucleophilic attack. So we have the nucleophile and the electrophile. Another example of that would be an alcohol using its lone pairs to attack a protonated, in this case, let's make it an aldehyde. And I'm showing all the lone pairs. Normally, I don't always show all the lone pairs. And the lone pairs are going to attack the carbon, which is partially positive, and a bond is going to break, and electrons are going to shift up onto the oxygen. In this regard, we make a new chemical bond. So a new bond is formed between the oxygen and the carbonyl carbon. I still have the hydrogen attached here and the carbon that is attached there. I have one pair of electrons here. This gets a positive charge. And so the positive charge is conserved and just appears on the new atom on the nucleophile that attacked. So again, we have the nucleophile and the electrophile, and showing the new bond being formed. And the oxygen over here has two pairs, two lone pairs of electrons now, rather than just one, so that we can see where everything goes. All right, so that's, both of those are examples of nucleophilic attack. Let me do one more. We'll put one more nucleophilic attack in here. Let's work, because we worked from double bonds, we said that double bonds can be nucleophiles as well. So what we'll do is we'll take the double bond and use the electrons in the double bond to be able to take the hydrogen from an acid, from HBr. And what this is going to form is, let's even track where this hydrogen is here. And there were two hydrogens that were here. There are now three hydrogens out on this terminal carbon. There is still only one hydrogen in the middle carbon. That carbon now gets a positive charge. And if we highlight this carbon here as being the acidic, excuse me, that hydrogen as being the acidic hydrogen, that's where the hydrogen landed. And the other part of this is that I get Br with a negative charge. And so this is acting as the nucleophile and the electrophile. And and there's another good example. Okay, let's look at loss of leaving group is another type. So in loss of leaving group, this is where we have groups dissociating. And in this case, what we draw is a bond breaking and electrons going with the leaving group. So we can draw this in a couple of different ways, or highlight it out in a couple of different ways. I'll show you. So this is loss of leaving group. In this case, what we typically do is we look at a group and a bond that has been weakened for various reasons. And we recognize a group as being something that can come off. And that this bond is weak and able to break. And so what we typically do is we typically say that this is a leaving group, or we classify it as an LG, or sometimes we say it's a VLG, a very good leaving group. So when that group comes off and fragments, it takes its electrons with it. And so the electrons that were in the bond, if we think about this bond as being sort of the red bond here, these electrons were the electrons that were in that bond, which are now on the oxygen. The oxygen took the electrons with it. as it left. So there's one loss of leaving group. Another example in loss of leaving group would be to we'll have a bromide and an oxygen, a couple of double bonds, and then a negative charge. In this case, the loss of leaving group can be something being pushed out and the group taking its electrons with it, the result of which in the same sort of way that we tracked before, if those are all the electrons that were on the bromide and in the bond, I had the electrons in the bond, the electrons are now on the bromide and they have left with the bromide. And the new bond that has formed is this bond here. This is my new bond that has formed. And the bromide is the leaving group. So I have loss of leaving group. Next one is proton transfer. These are just acid-base steps. These are a little bit easier to recognize. In proton transfer, I can have different acids transferring protons. The bond breaks, the electrons go back to the oxygen. These can be seen as being electrophile and nucleophile as well. But in this case, because just a proton is being transferred, we tend to call it proton transfer rather than nucleophilic attack. That's how we're distinguishing between the two. So this really is a nucleophile. This really is an electrophile. And we could see it as being, a nucleophilic attack, but we put it under the guise of proton transfer because we're just looking at the transfer of the proton itself. And there are many different examples of proton transfer that we can draw. And it's just about finding examples where a proton is taken and the flow of electrons from one location to the next. So that would be the result that I would wind up getting there. So if we're looking at where things are occurring, the electrons that were in this bond are now the electrons that are giving rise to the negative charge. So that's where those electrons went. And the electrons that were on this oxygen that were the three lone pairs, if I think about this guy here, that's the new bond that's being formed, just tracking where those electrons are going. So the curved arrows are showing me the flow of electrons and where the electrons are going in each step. Here's yet another one. I can take and take a phosphorus that has a positive charge on it, two protons, and some base like hydroxide ion. And I can take the proton, pushing the electrons down into the bond with the phosphorus. And this makes a proton transfer where I get water. But I also get this thing, which is called a vitig. and there's no more formal charge, that the charges all disappear. So I went from something that was charged with negative charges to now something which is neutral. The phosphorus no longer has a positive charge on it, and I've got now a double bond such that the electrons that were in this bond are now in this bond. Okay, so those are proton transfers. Everybody with me doing okay so far? I'm just kind of blabbering along and you're just watching structures as they're being drawn. Looks like you guys are doing okay. All right, sometimes we can have rearrangements. So let's look at some rearrangements. And these rearrangements are structural rearrangements. So within the rearrangements, these are things like a proton that is in one position and a positive charge. Let's say that there's a hydrogen that's here and that positive charge is on the carbon. I can have a rearrangement where the proton transfers in its position. So the actual carbon structure has now changed. So if we track this hydrogen, the hydrogen is now in a new location and the positive charge has shifted in its position. Finn, can you slow down a bit or just when you scroll? Yeah, sometimes I'm scrolling fast. It's hard to leave everything on the screen and have it all up at the same time. Remember, I am making the notes available to you too. So the notes go up along with the videos so that you can go back and you can see all the notes. The iPad is fairly limiting in how small it is. And if I shrink it down, my only concern is I can keep more things on the screen, but everything gets a lot smaller and it just makes it a little bit harder to see. So I'll try to slow down a little bit, yes. And I'll try to keep some of those things on the screen as I'm going forward. This type of shift in this proton is called a 1-2 hydride shift. The hydride shift is because I'm going from position one to position two, and it's changing and jumping from one carbon to another carbon. So that's a 1-2 hydride shift. Another type of shift that we see is things like an alkyl shift. So it's not just hydrogens that can shift. But let's say I have a carbocation in this location, the carbocation can shift. The alkyl group can shift, moving the carbocation. Let me draw it in the same way. I don't want to turn it around. Oops, I grabbed the partial. All right. One of the main important things within organic chemistry is to keep everything oriented as much in the same way as you possibly can and not move it so that it looks almost identical every time you draw it so that things don't get moved around. The reason that this shift happens is because now it allows for resonance. And I can get resonance occurring, whereas in the structure previously, I could not get resonance occurring. I just drew that in the wrong spot. Now the positive charge out on that terminal end. So resonance, no resonance. And this is called a alkyl shift. And it's really a 1-2 alkyl shift. So much the same way that I had a 1-2 hydride shift, I can have a 1-2 alkyl shift. Doesn't that break resonance rules? Doesn't what break resonance rules? In terms of my resonance of my structure?
No, it's the changing of electrons from a methyl group onto.
Oh, I know what you mean. Okay, so this here is not resonance. it is a structural shift in the molecule. It is an alkyl shift. And it's not part of the resonance. It's occurring before the resonance. It's occurring to allow for the resonance, because remember that resonance makes things more stable. So when I go from this structure on the left that has no resonance to the structure on the right that does have resonance, this is a shift that, if I were to do it in an energy diagram, would be an exothermic type of chemical reaction where I'm coming down lower in energy because I'm allowing for resonance. And so the reason that the alkyl shift actually occurs is for stability reasons. We'll get to those later, so we don't have to focus so much on those right now. It's really just trying to get vocabulary down of, what do I mean by proton transfer? What do I mean by rearrangement? What do I mean by all of these different things? So as I come back in here and I look at nucleophilic attack, the nucleophilic attack is a cation and an anion, or lone pairs on a partial positive, or the nucleophilic attack is really about positive to negative. Actually, I should say negative to positive. So it's about negative using lone pairs attacking a positive charge, or lone pairs attacking a positive charge, or lone pairs attacking a partial positive charge. All of these things represent nucleophilic attack. Loss of leaving group is really about something leaving and taking its electrons with it. It's the fragment of a bond. And so what I have is I have X and Y, where Y is more electronegative for some reason. So this is an electronegative, let's say not electronegative, let's do it EN. So this is an electronegative group that takes its electrons with it, such that I get a positive charge and Y with a negative charge. Or it could be that I had X that had a Y on it that had a positive charge, and when this breaks, it breaks in the sense to go to X that has a positive charge, and Y becomes neutral. So those are loss of leaving group. Proton transfer, we said it. We said it in terms of acid base. It's all about proton transfer. And rearrangements, rearrangements are about changes in carbon structure. They're the migration of a group. To form new atom connectivity. So that's what rearrangements are. So another example of a rearrangement too, if just to show how changes in rearrangements can happen, let's take a five-membered ring system with an oxygen in the ring system and a positive charge out here. One of the things that can happen is that this bond can break and shift. And as it shifts, it creates now a new structure with the positive charge adjacent, such that now I can get resonance. So most of these rearrangements occur because they make a more stable molecule, allowing for resonance to actually occur. So what happened there is, if I go through a number and say, this is carbon number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, then oxygen was number 4, 3, 2, 1. One is now connected to 6. This is 7 that is out here. So one is now connected between 6 and 7. And number 5 is the one that gets the electrons on it. So this is 1, 2, 3. 4 was the oxygen. 5, 6, and 7 up here in the way that, that things have moved. Actually, I think I'm missing. What did I do? 5 connected to 6. 1 should be connected to 6. I think that's what I'm messing up on. Do over. Hang on. Something's not right. Big erase. Make it right again. Okay, let's do it this way. Let's do it incrementally. Incrementally, what we will do is we will draw the exact same image that we had, except we will erase only one bond and we will reconnect. So this bond is being reconnected to there. So what we're doing literally is we're taking the electrons, which are in here, and swiping them that way to make the new connectivity. So we will just draw that much of it just to see sort of what that looks like. This was the positive charge that was here. Now what we're going to get is this connectivity. The positive charge will now reside in this location. And when we translate that into a good model, so this was carbon number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. This is still number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. So now I can see that six-membered ring system and I can draw it out appropriately. And as I draw that out appropriately, the positive charge is here on number 5. And on number 6, the 7 bond comes off of it. And this was carbon number 1, 2, 3, and 4. Oh, much better. All right, so sometimes when this is a really good lesson, because it's a good lesson for everybody that you just watched me make. Sometimes even when you're drawing and you know what it is you want to achieve, if you don't number the carbons, particularly when you're doing rearrangements, it's very easy to make mistakes. And so sitting down and doing it stepwise and slowing down your speaking, slowing down everything, allows you to be able to make less mistakes. So while sometimes you feel like you need to rush and go faster, slowing things down is the way to do it the right way. All right, and the reason this rearrangement happened was because now I can have resonance from my oxygen pushing into that carbon that has the positive charge on it, and I can get resonance in there. So that's where that comes from. Let's see. Oh, I'm so tempted, but I'm out of time, and I don't feel like I wanna lecture all that much more. The next step really just has combining patterns. So it really is in the next step, literally, and this piece I could do fast, and then I won't do the long example I had, and then we'll call it quits. This last piece just takes a combination of patterns to show you how a chemical reaction can progress with different sequences to allow for a chemical reaction to take place. And I'll go in and I'll put in the arrows in just a second, and then we can just put names to things to show where they are and how the reaction is actually occurring, such that we can actually see the progression. Of an overall chemical reaction. Okay, so in this, what we've got happening is in the first step, a protonation. In the second step, what we have is we have the loss of leaving group. In the third step, what we have is a rearrangement. The next step that we have is a nucleophilic attack. And then we've got the final product. And so a chemical reaction can go through a lot of different steps, all in a reaction mechanism that leads to a product. And so while we're used to one-step reactions within Chem 1A and Chem 1B, within organic chemistry, mechanisms can be very lengthy, and the mechanisms can have many, many steps. And each one of those steps is a represented step in a chemical reaction in a process that takes you from point A to point B to point A. Come on there, that was not cool. Point A to point B to point C to point D to finally maybe a product. And that our overall chemical reactions can have many different transition states as the mechanism takes us from reactants to products. And that's all what we're going to kind of understand as we go forward. Okay. Dina, good life lesson. Yes. Finn, is this still an alkyl shift? That was an alkyl shift that I showed before. Yes, that was true. Eric, why does the rearrangement happen before the nucleophilic attack? That's a great question. And the answer to that question, Eric, is that we get nucleophilic attack before the rearrangement as well. But the rearrangements oftentimes happen faster than the nucleophilic attacks, because a reaction that is within a molecule, intramolecular, is a lot faster than intermolecular is way faster than intramolecular. So that when it requires a collision of two things, there's time for those two things to migrate and find each other. Whereas within a chemical reaction, within a single molecule, it's a bond vibration, and those bond vibrations are much happier, faster. So Eric, that's a great question, and we will talk a lot about that too. This was not meant to be all encompassing. This is just an overview of looking at how we can take all these different steps and put them into one mechanism. Francisco, should the second step have two H's? Oh, crap. I don't know where I lost. Second step, two H's.
Yeah, right after the protonation, there's an alkyl group on the left.
Oh, yeah. I made it into an alkyl group instead of a hydrogen so that water comes off. And yeah, thank you. You caught an error there. Excellent. Ying, for rearrangement, how do you determine which group to use to do the migration? Oh, again, this was not meant. Okay, expectations. Let's be very clear in expectations. You're only at this point being asked to put a name to a reaction. So if I give you a drawing, can you tell me what type of step it is? That's all you're being asked to do. I am not asking you to find the rearrangement or to know where the group migrates. That is a whole chapter in and of itself when we start to look at carbocations, and we will do a whole study thing on that. So the expectation now is not for you to be able to do these steps when given the name. The expectation is, can you name them when you see the step? Not only that, but can you put the arrows into the right places? For instance, if I got rid of all of the arrows in this mechanism, could you put the arrows back where they belong? Oops, deleted too much there. Could you put the arrows back where they belong to complete the mechanism? That is the expectation, as well as putting the name to the type of step. So not knowing how to move things. So trying to have clear expectations. Okay, so Ying, don't worry about how to rearrange or which group to move right now. Not important right now. And Eric, for example, is it possible to turn butane into isobutene this way or butane into 1-methylpropane? Yes and no. We need to go through the rules, and I need to show you how it works, why it works, and what governs it in terms of stability. And we'll see from there. So again, a good question, not ready to deal with it just yet, because I need to show you a lot more before we can deal with that. This was cool. It's like I got to all the good stuff. And this is like my favorite part. And this is why I said this is one of my favorite sections to lecture on, is because one, Hammond postulate, and two, we start getting into reaction mechanisms. And as we start getting into reaction mechanisms, your minds start to just explode with all these different possibilities, and all the questions start coming out, because here's where we're really starting to deal with organic chemistry. Here is where we're going to start to see, how do we make things? What governs these chemical reactions? How do I control it? How do I, all of these different things about actually making something with organic chemistry. How do we control the organic chemistry to make particular products? What are the different chemical reactions, and how is one material transformed into another material by a chemical reaction? That's all the exciting stuff of organic chemistry. And that's exactly where we're going. And this is exactly where it starts to explode and where the semester really starts to get fun in terms of what it is that we're studying. All the other stuff was just sort of introduction to get us to this point. Here is where we start really having the fun. So that's why I'm excited, and that's why I'm jazzed about this one. So thanks for hanging in there with me for a little more time. Finn, does the product usually have resonance after the governing steps? Resonance is but one factor that can help a product formation, because you're going to a more stable product. So yes, we're going to see that resonance plays a very heavy role. Not always, but will often play a heavy role in why things are moving around the way they're moving. So yeah, good question, Finn. All right, I'm going to cut it there unless there's any more questions. You guys are welcome to hang on, and I'll answer any questions I can, just like I would after class. And other than that, I will see the afternoon lab in afternoon, and I'm going to knock on wood, hopefully have a better afternoon than I did this morning. But thank you guys for your attention. Thanks for a great class. And I'll see you guys later this afternoon.
Thanks, Jason.
You're welcome.
Hey, Jason.
Yeah.
So I offered to hold another SI to help them with their quiz, because I really didn't know how to help them with that.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering maybe this is something that I shop on another Zoom with you for, or just email you, but I'm wondering how I can help them, or what I'm supposed to say about it, or because I don't know whether to tell them that they're right or you know what I mean.
What I typically do is just ask them more questions. And so rather than telling them whether they're right or wrong, ask them, have they thought about this or have they thought about that? Or what does that mean?
Yeah.
I think that the goal of you and I talked on email about this a little bit, and it's okay if everybody hears this too, is that the goal of some of those quizzes is oftentimes to get them to debate between themselves, because some people will feel very strongly one direction, some people will feel very strongly another direction. Mm-hmm. And it is the act of the debating, the act of the arguing and the drawing and the communicating that forces them to find language to express their ideas, but also forces them to analyze and investigate other people's ideas and to maybe change their minds about how they feel about something. And so, yes, I absolutely did not try. Yeah, I'm trying to start a war. That's exactly what I'm trying to do, Dina. In fact, what I frequently say to people is that, and I say this to other instructors, the more arguments I can create within OCHEM in an academic good way, the more success I'm having. So when people start running to my office hours and they're like, I need to know the answer to this, we've been arguing over this for hours, I'm just like, yes, I am like, success, that just did exactly what I wanted it to do. Because it's engaging you guys in multiple modes. It's getting you to communicate. It's getting you to share ideas. It's getting you to communicate your ideas and use your voice and use your vocabulary to talk about things. So I do it on purpose. I put those examples in on purpose that I didn't lecture on it entirely. I didn't give you enough information to have a super strong opinion one way or the other. It may force you to read the book a little bit. And it's not meant to be punitive or mean and it's done in a very small, controlled sort of way. It's the same sort of thing that I do with the co-ops a little bit. But it's meant to push you and to get you to communicate and to get you guys to work together to try to build consensus on what you think it is in a safe sort of way. So there's not a whole lot of points attached to it. Problem-wise, when I get the quiz back, a wrong answer, the way that I look at it versus a right answer is more about what your argument is and how you're arguing it and how you're looking at it. And that allows me to go, well, wait, did you think about this though? Look at this idea or look at this concept. And so, Linnea, what I would say is try not to give them the answers as much as if they're missing a component or not thinking about something, then ask them to think about that thing.
Okay. But regardless, they should still be able to get with the book or whatever, they should still be able to get the entirety of it shouldn't, I guess I'm wondering if they should be able to get all of it. letting you know.
Well, I think if you read the question, what I asked is, are those stereocenters or not?
Okay.
Not what the configuration of the stereocenter is. And so while some of those may be difficult to decide, they can still decide whether or not it's a stereocenter, a true stereocenter, or whether or not it's affecting the stereochemistry. So what I asked was, label all of the stereocenters. And the second thing I said is, what is the relationship between the two compounds? So they didn't have to tell whether it was R or S at certain things.
Okay.
They just had to label the stereocenters and then figure out the relationship between the two compounds.
Okay. And then what time is lab starts at?
2:30.
Okay. I might hold like a little SI for those of anybody that wants to come on. Just because yesterday I thought that maybe there was a chance that it was going to be like, I didn't want to like go into all of it if you were going to like start doing something with it today and then like extend the quiz or something. So
I was a lecture on it today. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know what like, yeah. I didn't know why you were being so mean.
Cause I'm an asshole. That's why. No, it's just part of my standard MO. I know. Yeah, you get it.
Yeah, I took your class.
Exactly, I know. And so every once in a while, I throw these out. I mean, one of my favorite quizzes ever was a quiz, and I haven't done it in a while, was a quiz where I give a question, I give a chemical reaction or something that you've never seen before, I haven't lectured on, mm-hmm. and I ask, what questions do you need to ask in order to get the information to answer this question? So I don't want to know what the answer to the question is. I want to know, what is it that you need to know before you can even decide how to answer the question? So how do you develop and ask questions when you don't know what the answer is? That's one of the keys to learning, is being able to formulate your own questions, knowing enough to know what it is you don't know. And I can't base a decision until I know these things. Until I know, how good is the leaving group? How strong is the bond? What factors will support the leaving group in leaving in terms of solvents or heat or those types of things? So figuring out how to ask the different types of questions is key, because once you can ask a question, then you have an infinite number of resources in the internet and in the textbook and in all the other factors to be able to go and address those.
Yeah.
So as soon as you can ask the question, you can find the answer. You just need to know how to find the question first. That's the harder part.
Okay. Okay, cool. Yeah, I'll just hold an SI or something and try to have other people help them out.
Yeah. Just send out an email.
I'll just send out an email basically saying, like, I'll be on Zoom from, like, now till lab or
probably. There you go.
Probably not that long, but
yeah. And I'll be in an office hours too. I'll send out an email so that if people want to hit me in office hours, they're welcome to do that too. I would say by all means, you go ahead and go on. People can jump in and out of the sessions between you and me all they want to. And we can go through this and we can help them out.
Okay, cool. Sounds good.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
You're welcome. You guys are welcome. Thanks, Dina.